Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Hello, my name is Nigel Jones and I'm Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's podcast, which is going to be on the subject of taking the plunge and buying a dental practice and the essential aspects that you need to consider before you actually make that decision. I'm very lucky today to be joined by Sarah Jarvis, who is the Regional Healthcare Relationship Manager for Wesleyan Bank. So welcome, Sarah. Thank you very much for being with us. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
So I'm relatively new to Wesleyan Bank, but I have been working in the healthcare sector for around about 5.5 years, covering a wide range of sectors, including dentistry, which is obviously why I'm here today, and veterinary, pharmacy, and the GP market. So I've been in that for a while now.
Okay. So you mentioned about having a bit of time in dentistry. I think from what I've seen as an outsider looking into it, goodwill values seem to be going up, all these sorts of things. Is now a good time for someone to be looking to buy?
It's a tough question because obviously it's always market led, but I think any time's a good time to buy realistically in the dental sector. It is a very buoyant market, and if you look at market trends, it just seems to be going up and up and up and up. Just on some statistics, around about 2 years ago, I think the average price for the NHS goodwill was around about 150% of turnover. Now you're looking at around 200, and touching in South East on about 300% of turnover.
Wow.
So the growth is astronomical, really, when you think about it. And in that short period of time, we're talking around about 2 year mark. The same goes with practice, with private practices, around about 91% it was about 2 years ago. And I think the average now is about 120% of turnover, where I'm seeing 130, 150 sometimes.
Really, that phenomenal increase. So you've used a comparison there between NHS and private practice. What do you see as the pros and cons of the different types of practices you could buy?
Where to start? There's quite a lot, and I think it is a lot on the individual. So it depends what you want to get out of the business. At the end of the day, this is a business, and it depends how you want your business to run and how you want to run the business. Pro is that you've almost got a mandated income, which you're going to be getting every month. That money is going to be coming to you. And as long as you meet the requirements of the NHS and you are doing the minimum amount of UDAs, then you're going to continue to receive that income. The other good thing as well is that you're more likely to retain patients. So I think there's a bit of a saying that if you go to an NHS dentist, you go to the practice. If you go to a private practice, you go to the dentist. So that's kind of how one way I view things. So that's some positivity around the NHS. But there are some cons as well around that. And that is that actually in the buying process, there are the time taken to complete on an NHS practice can be significantly longer. So in a private practice, you can look around 3 to 6 months. If you're buying a practice, either a mixed practice or an NHS practice, you're looking at between 6 and 12 months, realistically.
Right.
You can push it through a little bit quicker, but I've seen them take a little bit longer as well.
So what's the difference there? What makes it longer?
So obviously there's the actual way of dealing with it, so the legality of it all, and the way that you put the process through, so all the DBS checks and things that have to be done. There's a set order that they need to be done in, and if they're not completed in that order, it can continue to restart. So there's a lot of box ticking that you don't have to do if you're doing the private side of things. There's also additional restrictions as well. You can't just move the practice if you decide that you want to move to another town. There's tight restrictions on that. So that's quite often where people, even just moving around the corner, that can cause some kind of difficulties there. So they're kind of, that's a bit about the NHS, and that you have to consider as well when taking on a mixed practice, because you are tied with the NHS side of things. see, the private side of things, they're cheaper to buy. So you quite often you end up having lower debt quantum, which is always nice. And they do tend to be as well, if they're well run, more profitable. So you have higher income. But then on the other side, people are used to going to that dentist. If that dentist leaves, then you have to try to ensure that you pick up the patients correctly and that you are continuing to service them in a way that they're going to continue to come to you, just as they've been coming to Mr. Smith the last 20 years. So that is a higher risk, and I think there is a bigger patient dropout on private practices when purchased. But then you do have the plus side of, if you have got a membership plan in place, that can give you a fixed income. So I think it's just more about who you are as an individual and how you want to work the business and how you want to run your business. If you want that freedom, then a private practice might be more for you. If you want a guaranteed income with the potential to build it up, then I think it's more on the individual.
Yes, I think that point that you've just made, Sarah, about membership plans, inevitably I'm going to pick up on that, given that I'm from practice plan. But I think you're right, it's partly about cash flow, but also the fact that the patient is tied to the practice through a direct debit means that they're what seem to be more likely to give the new dentist a chance.
Exactly.
So I think you can hang on to more patients if you've got a membership plan, which I guess, does that impact on the goodwill valuations as well?
It does, yes. I can't tell you exact figures on how it does, but I do know that banks will look at a practice more favourably if there is a membership plan in place, because like you've just said, it ties the patients into the practice and the patients are more likely to be brought into the practice in that particular plan, and therefore they're not going to want to change unless something drastically changes.
So membership plans are one thing that a bank might look at. Mm-hmm. But I guess plans of a different type, a business plan, is quite important.
Yes.
To the whole process. So what sort of things do you need to think about when you're creating a business plan, and you know, what makes a business plan truly robust in the eyes of the bank?
I mean, lots of people come to me and they say, do I really need a business plan? This business is working. What do you want to see in a business plan? And I think another thing, it is quite unique to the individual and the practice. Obviously, what I'd like to see in the business plan, coming from a banking perspective, is I want to see, obviously, what you're going to do, why you want this practice, what makes this practice the one that you're going to succeed in, and how you're going to improve this practice and achieve your goals that you want. Quite often people come to me and they say, oh, I'm going to improve this practice by 20%. And the first question that comes out of my mouth is how? And that's what I want to see in the business plan. I want to see that you've thought a step ahead of me and that you are considering this as a long-term investment, and how you're going to achieve your goals. It's very different so say for example, if you are just buying an NHS practice and that's your plan, you want to run that NHS practice as it is, no further income, no further investment required. Something that's really impresses me is that people have actually done their research, because I believe that if you're going to invest this much money, you need to know what you're buying and what you're looking to do. So someone that comes to me and says, look, Sarah, I've identified this opportunity, I've done my market research in the area and I can see that there is a shortfall in this service and my skills will fit lovely into this, and I believe that by doing this I will be able to increase my turnover because I will be able to access this part of the market that nobody else can or nobody else has, and I can utilise this and improve my business this way. I mean, things like that obviously shows that they have taken it to the next level, and that as a bank, that's kind of what we want to hear, because if we're going to lend the largest sum of money, we want to make sure that it is in safe hands.
Yeah, I can see that demonstrates they put some proper thought into it, and it's not just a sort of flippant decision to make, which I guess does happen. How often do you get really robust business plans then?
Not enough. I'd love to say that everybody that come to me had truly thought of the opportunity and had considered every angle of it in the same aspect that we have. But to be honest, obviously we're the bank, that's what we're here for. So we do our best to support people and to coach people into to getting to that level of understanding and of research, because that's what we do as well. So
we work
together with the individuals.
Excellent. So you would maybe get someone who came to you and you thought, actually, this just isn't strong enough for me to be able to sanction lending. Mm. And you give them a bit of a guidance about what they need to come
definitely.
Back to you with, and then gradually shape it over a period of time.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realise you did that. So that's got to be really helpful for them. So that maximises the chance of them securing the funding they need.
Yeah, and I mean, we're here to work with people. At the end of the day, we all want the same thing. We want the transaction to go through. We want people to acquire their perfect business. So by working together, as long as it's the right deal to do, we will support people in every way we can.
So you mentioned when you were talking about the sort of things that give you confidence about the research and that sort of thing, that the demographics. How important is location, do you think, when it comes to choosing a practice?
I think if I was doing a checklist on buying a dental practice, location would probably be one of the first things I looked at. I think it's crucial for many points, and it's different for NHS and private. I don't mean to keep separating them out, but they're different entities, and they're completely different the way that what they require from a location. If you have a demographic that is poorer, setting up a high-end, top-spec private practice, it's not going to go well. It has gone well. Some people have made a success of it, but as a rule, you don't want to go against trends. And I think that things to consider is how easy accessible is your practice. NHS practices need to be compliant with the DDA, so having a practice on the first or second floor could cause you problems. Having a practice that is easy accessible by public transport, especially if you're in central London, you want to be able to, or even in the outskirts of London, you want to be able to get to your practice by all modes of transport. People that can't drive want to be able to get their bus routes. All these things need to be considered. And I think that too often people as well, I think a lot of people are guilty. They think, oh, it's only 2 hours away from me, it's going to be the perfect practice. You need to make sure that it suits you personally. If you're going to be working at that practice, okay, 2 hours away doesn't seem like long, but if you're doing that, and then plus all the extra hours you're going to be putting in, you're adding in 10 hours onto your weekly workload, which could already be 70, 80 hours, unfortunately,
yeah.
Which realistically long term is just not maintainable. So I think that a lot of people, it's a very competitive market, and a lot of people really, really want to get a practice, and I think, but they just need to consider their personal life.
I think that's a really important point, that extra 10 hours if you've got a 2 hour drive. I can totally see that. That's that trying to find the right balance between not being so embedded in amongst all your patients that you see them in the supermarket versus being so far away that it actually puts extra pressure on you. I can see that being a serious consideration.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that you give quite a bit of guidance then, a lot of support to help someone who's potentially going to acquire a practice think through all the issues, not just those that directly relate to the funding, but also that relate to just how successful they're going to be in the future and how happy, I guess, they're going to be. So what sort of things do you think people should be thinking about when they're choosing the right lender for them?
I think there's a lot of lenders out there, and this is a very buoyant market, and a lot of people are looking to lend into the healthcare sector. And I think that you need to be comfortable with who you're borrowing from. You need to be comfortable that the person that you are going to about possibly one of the most expensive decisions of your life actually understands you and what your long-term and short-term goals are. Obviously, from my perspective, people I work with, I look to continue to support them. I try to make them think short, medium, long-term goals, because that's how I think about things. And I think that it's not always about the rate or who can get me this the quicker. This is a long-term decision. Sometimes, obviously, you could have 20, 25-year money. So do you want to be committed to somebody you don't particularly like for 20, 25 years? So having that relationship with somebody and knowing that they're a sector specialist as well. The dental sector is very unique in the fact that the way that we lend against the goodwill of the business, there's not many sectors that will have borrowing against goodwill, and goodwill only sometimes on short-term leases. So having someone that truly understands the business and the sector and how they can work with you long-term, I think is the most crucial thing out of when you're choosing your lender.
Yes, I'd agree with that entirely, Sarah. I think it's really important that you've got someone that can support you and views it as a partnership for the long term rather than just a quick transaction of some kind. I can see that. And I guess that can get you into all sorts of areas. I suppose as part of a business plan, you might be looking for a cash flow forecast of some description. How equipped are most dentists at putting one of those together?
I mean, there's lots of tools, and with individuals, some are better scoped than others to do this. And I think along with having a specialist bank manager, this is where the other specialists come into play. So cash flow forecasts are very important for the fact that you know where you're going to be, and almost as like a tick list of your development. So sometimes when you buy a practice, you get so involved in the business that you forget actually what you're doing and why you're here. And at the end of the day, you're buying this business to make money. And I think having a cash flow forecast as a reference point to make sure you're on track, to make sure things don't slip, like, it's always nice to refer to. And being able to go to a specialist accountant to get that service, I think having people on your side that understand the sector and what struggles you're going to have, and even just understanding what sector norms are. So you could go to an accountant who's never dealt with a dental practice, and they'll just tick it all off, and then when you realise that you're making 15% less than everyone else, but he doesn't know that because he doesn't have the specialist knowledge. So I always think of cash flow forecasts as, yeah, I do look at them from a banking perspective, but I think they're more important for the dentist, almost as a checklist to say how they're going and how things are on track.
Maybe. Yeah,
that's how I see them.
I agree, Sarah. I'm surprised that there aren't more practices that have cash flow forecasts, have budgets, have management accounts, whether that's monthly or quarterly or whatever, because the feeling of control that you get with that, I think, is immense. Whereas I think a lot of practice owners find the running of a dental practice is very stressful. And I think a lot of that's related to feeling slightly out of control. Yeah. But I guess from a bank's perspective, what you're looking for is someone that's got a clear strategy for how they want to take the practice they're purchasing forward, but then also demonstrate some kind of competence around the ongoing management of that practice once they're in place.
Yeah, from my perspective, I do work with my dentists, and I want them to provide MI as a norm, not as a chore. I don't want them to just provide it because the bank asks for it. I want them to provide it because I want them to see what they're achieving from the practice. And I mean, some businesses have dips and like peaks and troughs, and it's kind of a little bit about just understanding how your business is working, and not just being there, not being a busy fool, not just working and working and working, finding out what's working well, what's profitable for you. Are you making a lot of money on this? Are you making a loss on this? Are you using enough in marketing? Finding out all of those things. And I don't think, unless you have a tight control on the financials, monthly, quarterly, whatever your preference is, I honestly don't think that you can fully maximise your business's potential.
Yeah, that makes lots of sense. You touched on marketing there, and one of the things that I'm still slightly surprised is that there's so many practices that haven't got a proper digital presence at the moment. So many have either not got a website at all, or the one they've got isn't really helping the practice. Well, do you stray into that sort of area at all?
The first thing I do when anyone contacts me is I search for them online. So I will go through, I will type in the name of the practice, I will type in the person's name, I will research everything I can online, sometimes before I even send out an offer, purely because from that I can generally understand what the starting point is and where we need to get to. if I was, from my perspective, if I was looking for any service, the first thing I do now is I go to the internet and I check reviews. I'll check reviews on NHS Choices. I'll check reviews on Google. Yale.com even has reviews. All of these services that you use to review things. And I think we are in a digital age, and everything that can be done online is being done online. And I think having a digital presence, even if it's just a website, a social media account that's just updates sporadically, having that, I think, will put you above the practices that don't have it. Because if you've just moved to an area, the first thing you do is go to Google, I need a dentist, type in dentist. And if you don't come up, then they're not going to come to you because they can't find you. You haven't got that presence. People don't walk around the streets now looking for a dentist anymore. People go online. People still refer, but if you're new to an area, then you need to have that strong digital presence. Some of the best dental practices websites I've seen, you can do everything from book online to meet the dentist. I think that's such a powerful thing when you have little profiles of the dentist. A photo as well, having a photo of your dentist associates, I think that is such a powerful thing, and I think a lot of people are missing the trick with that. And anyone who I work with, I always suggest that they're expensive, but the reward is, it's not even comparable to what you're going to get from having a good looking website.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, Sarah, because it's, I think for an awful lot of people, when they're thinking about approaching a bank for funding to purchase a practice, I'm not sure it enters their head to think that they might end up getting some kind of business coaching and some general all-round business advice that strays into even things like what photos go on your website. I don't think people would imagine that. But everything you're saying, I completely agree with. I think that makes perfect sense. Thank you very much, Sarah. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.